Okay, so yesterday we saw that there is some kind of nice way to think about second quantization of free theories. So we started roughly with, say, a single particle, and then we went to consider a gas of these particles by, instead of taking the space, we take a symmetric product. But actually from that you don't really learn that much. The interesting thing, I think, and that's what I want to stress in these lectures, is that this way of thinking about second quantization opens up the possibility to also include the interactions in the theory in a natural way. And there will be actually two kind of ways in which we will do this. So in matrix theory, we'll actually do something else. Instead of taking the coordinates, we will take the coordinates to be matrices, like Hermitian matrices, Xij, still D of them. And of course, there we see that these, since they are now matrices, they typically will not commute. However, there is a way, so here they are n by n matrices. However, if we now take a special limit in which we enforce that these matrices do commute, we can simultaneously diagonalize them and think of their eigenvalues as being this living in this symmetric space. So I want to, so we will be aiming at this description over here, and the conclusion will be that this somehow does two things at the same time. It both second quantizes the theory and it introduces the interactions in a convenient way. There's somehow a variation on the theme that I also will discuss at the end, is that you can also do something else. Instead of considering these symmetric spaces, you can consider more general manifolds, which are somehow deformations of the symmetric product. So we will also go to situations where we here have some more complicated manifold of the same dimension, which is in some way a resolution of this symmetric product. Of course, when the space itself is no longer a symmetric product, we can't describe it in terms of n particles. So the description in terms of these gas of particles disappears. But that's the whole issue of an interacting field theory. If you have an interacting theory, particles can collide, form another particle, so the whole concept of number of particles is not well defined. So these are kind of two ways to think about interacting field theories or interacting string theories that really make use of the description I used yesterday. So that's why I started my lecture by going through that formalism. So at some point you can say, aha, now I see at least the non-interacting theory appearing in this particular way. So in order to put this in the right physical context, however, I have to say a few words about light cone quantization, and that's the subject I now want to start with before I introduce these matrix theories. So this is a little of an aside, but it is very important. Also, I think for mathematicians, it's a kind of a different way to think about quantum systems, quantum field theories, than we are kind of used to. So the idea is I take some space, some Minkowski space, and I write it in terms of a 1 plus 1 dimensional light cone times, say, some Riemannian manifold Y, d-dimensional manifold. And I use coordinates here, x plus minus, say, Y. And the metric on this manifold, the important thing, of course, that the metric on this light cone plane is dx plus dx minus. And then there is some metric gij, dyi, dyj on the remaining compact space. This is not necessarily compact, but Euclidean space. So this space I will typically refer to as the transverse space. Now, just a few notations. So we have this light cone here with coordinates x plus x minus. These are kind of null directions. And just a notation for momenta, so p plus with an upper plus, which is the same thing as a p with a lower minus, is the thing which is naturally conjugate to ddx to x minus. This is the usual notations, but I probably write quite, well, both notations I will probably use. And P upper minus, which is the same thing as P lower plus, is the thing which is dual to the plus, x plus coordinate. Now, what you do if you want to describe a point particle, say, in this particular description, the Lightcon description, you use the x plus coordinate as your time coordinate. So that's something which we are not kind of used to. Usually time is not a nil direction. But now so you can think of the x plus being, and typically equation is like this, that you write x plus in terms of the eigen time of the particle with some constant p plus sitting there. That means that you should think of having your states kind of specified on this plane and then evolving in the other nil direction. So this is the way in which we want to describe Lightcon quantization. It's, on the one hand, it's rather ugly, but it's in many cases the only thing we kind of know, particularly for interacting string theory. It's very difficult to write down a Hamiltonian or something else, not in this formalism. Right. It has various problems, in particular with things which are, say, localized in the x plus plane, because the so-called zero modes. And actually, you won't actually have much deep to say about that, certainly in the mathematical language. But there are various, I think, conceptual problems surrounding this. We have to face them in some way. One of the nice things, of course, is since you pick a null direction, unless like a time direction, that the group, so you break, of course, this Lorentz group down to actually the thing which is the Galilei group in d dimensions. You have matrices, say, of the form A, where this is a rotation, 0, here you have, a velocity appearing. That's just a stabilizer group of a nil direction. Sorry?
You get the central extension of the
Galilei. No, I think you get the algebra form by these kind of matrices, I think. So one way to see this is if you... so I should write this down too. So the Hamiltonian, the light cone Hamiltonian, still want to have a Hamiltonian operator. I still will call it H, but will now be the thing which describes the evolution in the x plus direction. And so this is actually what you typically would call P minus. It's the momentum P minus. Now, we often will use a variation of this formalism, the so-called discrete light cone quantization, in which we take the x minus coordinate to be periodic. So we have x minus identified with x minus with 2 pi r, and I will actually quite often put r to 1 in many examples. So that means that we work with a manifold, which is something, a cylinder, S1r, but say with a Minkowski metric on it. But this is the awful space we will be working with. One of the nice things that if x minus is periodically identified, the p plus coordinate, being ddx minus, now has an integer spectrum. Right, so it will typically have eigenvalues of the form capital N over R, with n being an integer. This n will in the end be identified with the n of the symmetric product. So in that sense, it's the same notation. Of course, the decompactified model, where this thing is no longer periodic, you can obtain by sending both r and n to infinity, keeping this p plus fixed, and then it can approach any real number. Now, it's nice to just describe, so if you have a massless particle, so it has some momentum, p squared equal to 0. One way, indeed, that's the way you can, for instance, see very nicely this Galilei group appearing. Then in terms of its components, so p plus, p minus, and say the transverse momentum, you write this equation and you see that you can write p minus as p squared over 2 p plus. And you can recognize that this is somehow the would be, say, the standard Hamiltonian of a free particle, where the mass is now given by the number p plus. So p plus is fixed in the formalism and plays kind of the role of the mass of a particle moving in this d-dimensional space. So it means that at some point, although we are describing a relativistic system, we will have kind of non-relativistic quantum mechanics on this transverse space Y. And that also kind of explains why yesterday I was basically only describing sigma models and quantum mechanics on this transverse space, and using it with just in a completely classical mechanical sense, non-relativistic sense, using this Hamiltonian, which is just a Laplacian. Now, it's perhaps just instructive to see the quantization in this scheme of a very simple example. Say, let's do a two-dimensional scalar field. Well, actually, you can do a more general case of a scalar field on this, but let's first start with two dimensions. So a scalar field living on this space as 1R, 1-1. And in that case, we just have, say, a conformal field theory. So we have a map phi from S1 cross R. Say, well, we can actually take a general vector space V. And then, of course, P plus can be identified with L naught and P minus with L naught bar. And the Lagrangian of such a theory will now simply look like D plus phi, D minus phi. So how would you quantize in this scheme? Well, you start with the field, say the operator valued field, is a function of x minus, which is a periodic coordinate. So you can make a Fourier decomposition here. Let me do it in a standard way, where I exclude the zero mode. So the zero mode is always a tricky part of the theory. I just want to forget about it here in this quantization. So this is the usual expansion of phi, and these alpha n's form the usual Heisenberg algebra. And so you get a Fock space, which is the Fock space I was actually describing yesterday. It's just a Fock space, which is built out of all the symmetric products. So we have a n labeling these creation annihilation modes of the symmetric products. And we can introduce again this notation, where we have this infinite sums of symmetric products, generating functions of symmetric products. So for instance, if you now would compute the partition function of this theory, so in some sense, if you wish, you can think of this, doing this light cone quantization as kind of picking out the chiral component that you would have in the usual quantization of a conformal field theory. You only have kind of the left moving modes here now. So if you compute the partition function here, so we should realize that the classical equations of a field is d plus d minus phi equals 0, which tells you that in this case, actually, the light cone Hamiltonian, the p minus, is 0. That's because it's a field which is purely holomorphic, if you wish, or purely left-moving. So it already is moving in this direction. There's no evolving in the x plus direction, so that's very simple. And then we could compute something like the trace of phi, say, q to the L naught, where L naught is the p plus eigenvalue. So it's this number n appearing here. It's just a Fourier expansion in this compact direction. And here you get the usual partition function, say 1 minus q to the n minus the dimension of v. Now, it's a nice exercise to... So we see here, this is typically a character, again, of some Heisenberg algebra, or if you can recognize it also as the holomorphic part of a conformal field theory. And we obtained it slightly differently using this light cone quantization. Yes? Movers.
I would get both.
Yes.
So just because I changed the quantization scheme, how should I get a difference?
Sorry? I throw away the zero mode. So the zero mode is the thing which doesn't depend on x minus and only has x plus direction. So that's precisely the modes that I was missing. So I threw away the zero mode. Right. In this case, it's half of it. But in a more general case, it will be some co-dimension, say, of the full space. But here it's indeed something which you kind of have to add in, but I want to. So perhaps it's instructive to do also the case of a scalar field in on the general manifolds of this type. So how would we quantize such a field? So suppose now we have a scalar field, which is a map, say, of this d-dimensional transfer space, and then we have S1 times R in the signature 1-1. Then, again, we can look at solutions of the classical equation, if you wish, which are just Laplacian and phi equals 0. But, of course, now we can make an ansatz for such a solution. It would typically be an exponential, say, with p plus x minus plus p minus x plus. And then we take a field, say, phi k of y, which is a solution of the Laplacian on y. So we have the Laplacian on y acting on k. I think I want to put a minus 1/2 here. So we then diagonalize the Laplacian on the transverse space and now solve the Laplacian on the general space with this ansatz. And we find two things. So p minus is again fixed. So p minus we call n. Oh, sorry, p plus we call n. And then we find that p minus is what? Well, it's actually it's this epsilon k over n, because that's the general formula I wrote over here, which is that the p minus is the p squared, which is the eigenvalue of the Laplacian on the transfer space, divided by p plus. So if you wish, you can write this as the eigenvalues of h over n, but this is the Hamiltonian on this transfer space y. So we see that if we have a mode of the scalar field which has this longitudinal momentum n, that this corresponding light cone Hamiltonian is, if you wish, the usual quantum mechanics Hamiltonian on y divided by n. And that's the result which I briefly showed yesterday, where I showed that if you build up the Fock space, so the whole Fock space there, I had a formula which is basically the same formula as I wrote over here. It was something like this. It was labeled by an overall integer, which is the total p plus momentum. And then I had Hilbert spaces with some index n. And this Hilbert space was just supersymmetric quantum mechanics on y, with the property that the Hamiltonian was the ordinary Hamiltonian, but rescaled to the factor 1 over n. So the big Fock space I built up yesterday, we see, is the Fock space of a second quantized scalar field moving on this manifold across an extra two light cone variables and in this light cone quantization. So the only thing that perhaps we should take away from this is that from the typical Fock spaces I was building yesterday are the ones which appear if you do quantized free fields in this light cone quantization. So unfortunately, two things are linked together in physical applications. Now, probably won't be doing all this if it wasn't the case that for string theory, light cone quantization is so very important. Basically, as I said, it's one of the few places where you actually can write down Hamiltonians also for the interacting theory. So let me now go through the light cone quantization of string theory. So this will be kind of roughly complementary to what Greg was doing this morning, because he kind of took the covariant approach. But now I want to discuss the light cone approach. So the light cone superstring. So again, we take our space-time manifold. It's actually a 10-dimensional space, which I write as this 8-dimensional transfer space. And then I also would like to use this compactified light cone plane. So S1 times R added to it. So now we have the string. So we typically have some world sheet, sigma, and I will almost always choose it to be a cylinder. So we have a spatial coordinate sigma, a time coordinate tau, and then we have a map X, which maps sigma into Y. This is the usual sigma model variable. So even though the string is moving in a 10-dimensional space, the fundamental degrees are the maps into this transverse space. Now, on Y, we have various bundles, which will be important. Sorry? I will in a moment say how X or how the other two coordinates depend given this map X. So they will be determined in terms of this 8-dimensional sigma model. So on Y, we have the tangent bundle, of course, which is rank 8. And then there are two spin-up bundles, the two spin representations of SO8, S plus and S minus. And of course, these are the three familiar representations, the vector, the spinner, and the conjugate spinner, the three SO8 representations that are related by triality of SO8. So in order to write down all the variables, we have this X, which means that D of X will be a section of, well, actually, the canonical bundle on sigma times, if you wish, the fullback of this tangent bundle. And then we have, so that's just the usual field which appears in the bosonic sigma. And then there are fermions, theta and theta bar. So theta is a spinner on the world sheet, and together with a section of this positive chirality spin bundle on Y. And theta bar is a section of the anti-holomorphic canonical line bundle, the square root of it. And then here we have a choice, which is the same choice that Craig discussed this morning, whether we take either the positive or the negative chirality spin bundle here, where plus corresponds to the 2B theory, and minus will correspond to the 2A. And actually, from now on, I will basically only discuss the minus theory, because the 2A theory is the theory which naturally can be kind of described using matrix theory in the most simple way. So we have a very simple Lagrangian. So let's take this case where this eight-dimensional manifold is just a flat space. Then there's a very simple Lagrangian. So this is the 2A Lagrangian. So it's the integral of just the free field theory. So we have this dxi, d bar xi, really very simple theory. Theta bar a dot del theta a dot. So a indicates the chiral spinner, and a dot the anti-chiral spinner. And of course, this can be generalized to a curved space sigma model if y is not a flat space. Now, what about the other two coordinates of the string? So the usual way is, so since it's light cone quantization, X plus is again fixed to be identified with the time coordinate on the sigma model. So this is always just a linear function of tau. And X minus is given by a constraint. And actually, one way to write a constraint is that it's given in terms of bilinear in the, well, I just write the bosonic piece. I hope I'm doing this right. One way to write it, actually, so plus, is as the stress tensor over P plus. X minus, yeah. So X plus and X minus are given. Here? The del. So this is the DZ, if you wish, or on the world sheet. And there's a similar expression for the D bar of it. And X minus is the integral of this, so you have to write down an integral expression for it. It's derivatives. Right, yeah. Anyhow, the important thing is that this is part of the light cone choice, and then basically this is a constraint which fixes X minus. In that sense, you can it suffice to have this 8 coordinates given in terms of... So P plus, as I said, is in always a light cone quantization you have to fix. So P plus will be N over R. And let me say one word about P minus. Well, you can determine P minus because it's actually just the zero mode of this expression over here. So you can compute it in terms of an integral, say, d sigma of, say, del X minus minus del bar X minus over R. And let's see, what am I doing here? No, not over R, over P plus. This is the expression for it. And so this you can also rewrite in terms of L naught minus L naught bar, because just, let's see, I'm doing here something strange. What am I doing? Not over P plus, of course, this is just like this. Right. In the end, I want to have this expression. I think I want to divide by R here. Probably by 2 pi R or something like that. Anyhow, it's then given in terms of the stress tensor by this number. Now, L naught minus L naught bar is an integer in the theory, but of course not necessarily divisible by M. Now, one way to see what the interpretation is of... I'm not quite sure what I... This is all nonsense. I don't want to write it. It's not P minus. Now, let me try to formulate it a bit carefully. So they have the string, but it's mapped into this space-time, which itself also contains a cylinder. It's this kind of light-cone cylinder where x minus is compactified and x plus is uncompactified. So now there is a winding number of this coordinate x minus. And that's the thing that I'm computing over here. So there is some integer, another integer, let's call it m, which you compute as the winding number of x minus. And but then I plug in this formula over there, and I see that it can be expressed as L naught minus L naught bar over n. This is what I wanted to say. Now, this is a general integer, but so I want to have this to be m, to have a right interpretation. So here you get an extra condition on the theory. So it means that not all the states in the conformal field theory I now defined are actually states of the string theory. There's one extra constraint, and that's the following constraint. This is the level matching. This is the condition that L naught minus L naught bar should be M times M. So it should be, we will only want to take the states whose eigenvalue of L naught minus L naught bar is some multiple of M. Now, in the case where you decompactify the theory, so in the case where you send n to infinity, did I write a little n somewhere? Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. This is a capital N. So in the case where you send n to infinity, this gives the usual level matching condition from L naught bar equals zero. Which is so away, yeah. If you want to have states with finite p minus. So finally, there is so that's one part. It means that there's a small truncation of the spectrum of the sigma model. And then there's the so-called Marshall relation. It tells you that the light cone Hamiltonian, p minus, can be given in terms of the conformal field theory Hamiltonian H divided by p plus. That's again the same thing. And so this is L naught plus L naught bar over P plus. So this gives you the interpretation of what the P minus eigenvalue is given the Hamiltonian L naught plus L naught bar and given the value of P plus. So this is the usual setup of light cone string theory. And I'm giving it this all because then we can appreciate when we do the matrix theory how it actually reduces to this formalism. There's one important thing I have to realize to describe is how the supersymmetries are realized in this theory. So the supersymmetries of the superstring, as we've seen this morning, there are 32 supersymmetries, but they're actually split into 16 plus 16, so-called broken and unbroken symmetries, which are very differently realized in this theory. So let's start with the unbroken ones. So these are the symmetries which have the following form. the bosonic coordinates transform into of the following type. Remember that all the spinners are all somehow kind of by triality isomorphic with the vector representation of SO8, so I'm free to lower and raise indices theta b. So here we see that we have left moving, they are left moving objects on the world sheet of the conformal field theory, but they are anti-chiral spinners in the world sheet. And similar, there are eta bars which transform as a chiral spinner. Of course, I should also write down the transformation rules of the fermions. And there's a corresponding supercurrent which generates these transformations, which looks like G A dot. So it's it's this zero mode of the following field dxi comma I a dot theta A. So you see that this supercurrent transforms as a conjugate spinner, an anti-chiral spinner of SO8. So this is the first supersymmetry. And that's actually the fact that we have 8 of these for the left movers and 8 of these of the right movers means that we have a conformal we have a super conformal field theory or a super symmetric sigma model with kind of the maximum number of supersymmetries, which is N8,8 supersymmetry. Now the other 16 supersymmetries are realized much simpler. They're just constant shifts of the theta variables. So the other ones, which I call epsilon A and epsilon bar A dot, they have the following simple property. The xi's are invariant under them, and the thetas just transform linearly. So these are the broken supersymmetries. And together we have 32. And it's interesting to see that using these 32 supersymmetries, you can realize the supersymmetry algebra in 10 dimensions. So let me just write that down too. This is all standard string theory. Right. Yes, not very fast. Yeah, if you think of them as the string as a as an object in space-time, then it breaks these 16. And it, the, since they're broken, they generate fermions, which are then the thetas. So the way you realize the supersymmetry algebra is in the following way. So we write the following expression. So here there are some square roots of p plus appearing. And so here is the generator of the broken supersymmetry, which is just, if you wish, the constant mode of these thetas. And then there is the unbroken one, which is 1 over square root p plus, the generator of the supersymmetry of the conformal field theory. And now it's a nice exercise to see what the commutation rules of these are. So you, for instance, you see that the first one, of course, very easy. QA with QB just gives P plus times the delta function, because these are just the fermions, and they are free fermions. Then if you try to compute QA with QB dot, the theta will have a non-trivial commutator with the theta part sitting in G, giving in the end the contour integral dxi comma I a b dot, which we recognize as just the left moving momentum of the string, of the zero mode of the string in these 8 transverse directions. So this is the usual supersymmetry, this is the part of the where the momentum sits in the transverse direction. And finally, which is the most non-trivial one, is to compute qa dot with qb dot. If you do the computation, you find this is, of course, part of the unbroken supersymmetry. These are the 8 supercharges that are realized in the sigma model. So here we get kind of the world sheet supersymmetry algebra. There's an extra factor 1 over p plus, which is in this normalization. Here you get, say, L naught, which you can also write then as a delta function times, if you wish, the Hamiltonian, the left-moving Hamiltonian over p plus, and this you identify with P minus, and this is part of the interpretation of the model. And that way you realize the supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. So this is what we about what you I want you to know about first quantized superstring in the light cone formalism. And now I want to show you how these things can be obtained by doing matrix theory. So this is actually the point I'm kind of starting over. This was kind of preparation. And now I'm actually starting my discussion of matrix theory. Sorry? This equation? Oh, here, of course, there's a gamma matrix here. So it's the usual supersymmetry algebra with here the gamma matrix. So in matrix theory, actually, what we start with is with supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So we start with super Yang-Mills with the maximum number of supersymmetries, which is 16. There are various ways to approach the theory. Either we can, the number of supersymmetries will remain the same. The thing is, in which dimension do we want to consider it? And one way to start is actually to start with consider it in the maximal dimension. So if you are in 9 plus 1 dimensions, it's what's usually called n equals 1 supersymmetry. So that means that the field content is very simple. We have a connection A, and we have one while spinner. So this is rank 16, and of course both transform in the adjoint of the group. Now the Lagrangian is very simple. Its Lagrangian is it's some coupling constant, and then it's the usual thing, so trace f h star f plus theta, then the Dirac operator theta. Now, this theory has a supersymmetry, which is easy to write down. The transformation rules are very simple. Since we have 16 supercharges, the parameter which labels the supersymmetry transformation is itself a wild spinner. So we pick a parameter which is, say, an element of this representation S plus. And as we've seen this morning, that is can be identified with a dual of S minus. And then the transformation rules are very simple. A mu transforms into the fermion. It's almost the same transformation I was just writing down. However, now, of course, all these objects are matrices, or they group valued, A and theta. And then d theta A transforms actually in the field strength. So here's f mu nu, gamma mu nu, A, B, theta B. Yes. Well, you have the Dirac matrix, which maps still. Right. This one? I thought the dual of this is naturally identified with the other chirality. It should be in your list. Yes. It's a 9-1% signature. So, and of course, here we have the notation that gamma mu nu is the commutator, the anti-commutator, is the commutator of two of the Dirac matrices. Now, so this is the art of classical transformation rules and the classical Lagrangian of 10-dimensional Yang-Mills. And now we can obtain various other Yang-Mill theories by considering these, the dimensional reduction of these theories by just having all the fields not depend on a few of the coordinates. So whenever I write in my lectures super Yang-Mills in D plus 1, I always talk about this Yang-Mill theory dimensionally reduced to that lower dimension. So just have the fields not depend on the remaining coordinates. Now, I want to start my discussion. So there are various points where I now could move to, but I actually, more or less for pedagogical reasons, I first want to discuss this theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So we take super Yang-Mills in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and we will see it's actually quite a rich theory. So we just take these fields and dimension reduce them. And what do we get? Well, first, of course, we get a connection. So again, let me consider this theory on a world sheet, which is the cylinder labeled by a space-like coordinate sigma and a time-like coordinate tau. So we have a connection, A mu, a two-dimensional gauge field. And then the eight remain, so we have kind of basically compactified on eight dimensions. So there are eight remaining components of the gauge field. And they, of course, from the two-dimensional perspective, are just scalar fields. So we have fields xi, where I runs from 1 up to 8. And there's a natural SO8 group here acting, a global SO8 group acting on the system, which this scalar is transformed as a vector under that SO8 group. And they all, and let me also pick the gauge group to be the unitary group. So these are all Hermitian N by N matrices. Hermitian N by N. And then we have the fermion, so we have to decompose our 10-dimensional Majorana-Weyl spinner in terms of the 2-dimensional spinner. So under the 2-dimensional Lorentz group times the SO8, and that's, of course, since they have a definite chirality in 10 dimensions, means that the chirality, say, on this surface, this world sheet, is correlated with the chirality under SO8. So we have a left-moving fermion, which I call theta, which transforms as a spinner of SO8, and there is a right-moving theta on the world sheet, which transforms as an anti-chiral spinner of SO8. So these are precisely, if you just go back to the construction of the superstring, it's precisely the same objects, however, they are now N by N matrices. And that's also why you see that the 2A theory is kind of more natural, because the 2B theory would have to like that this field also was a spinner of SO8, not an anti-chiral spinner of SO8, so it wouldn't be obtained as the dimensional reduction of a 10-dimensional theory. So we have to do something more complicated to get the 2B theory. So all of these are N by N matrices. And so there's an immediate remark to be made that if N equals 1, this is the usual superstring. So although there are various other ways to motivate the proposal, you could somehow take a bold step here and say, just take the superstring and make anything, any field that I see appear here, make it into a matrix. And that's a little bit kind of the approach I was advocating yesterday. Just let's see what happens. Now, of course, if you promote these fields into matrices, there's this UN group, and it's quite logical to introduce also a connection for it, to make it into a gauge theory. So, of course, what we now want to do is to just see what happens. So there are several things we have to do. First, of course, we have to see what happens if you quantize the theory. But you also have to say, what is the interpretation of the theory? Now, the interpretation will be that this is a 10-dimensional... Let me go slowly. So let me first write down the Lagrangian of the theory. The Lagrangian, of course, just a 10-dimensional Lagrangian, but now written out in these components, but it's still illuminating to write down the various fields. So let me go slowly here. So one way to write it is the following. So there's a coupling constant in front of it, which is the Young-Mills coupling constant, plays a very important role in what's coming. And then we get the usual Young-Mills term, f squared. Then there's a term which looks like dxi squared, just these eight scalar fields. And then there are the fermions, which I just have. So we have the left-moving fermions, which coupled to the covariance del bar operator. And then there are the right movers, which couple to the del operator, covariantized. And then there are terms which are really reflect the non-abelian nature of the object. There's a term which is a sum over I and j of the commutator squared of the x fields. Will play a very important role. And then there's finally a term which is couples the fermions to the bosons, xi, gamma i, theta. So one has a bar. So this is the Lagrangian. Now, there are several ways to look at it. You can think of, see it as a generalization of two-dimensional Young Mills, which has just this term F here. Another way to think about it is as a generalization of the sigma model Lagrangian. Then you would say that these terms over here are the terms that you start with. You promote the fields to matrices, and then you add these interaction terms, if you wish, and you add the gauge field and introduce the usual Young Mills Lagrangian for that. Now, one way I want to look at this theory is is to rescale the field slightly. So rescale the field X with an explicit power of the Young-Mills coupling constant, and also rescale theta. And then we'll see actually that the dependence on the Young-Mills coupling constant appears slightly different. So of course here it still sits. It will now not be present in the kinetic terms for the scalar and bosonic fields. But here, of course, it now appears upstairs. So this is the way I want to rescale my scalar fields in order to match most closely with the usual description of the string, the first quantized string. Now, there's an important point to be made, is that if you just see what the dimensions are of the theory, that the coupling constant, this coupling constant G Young-Mills, is not actually a number, but it has the dimensions of 1 over length. Just by, for instance, comparing with the fact that... So one way to say this is that this is not a conformal field theory. One way to see that it acts as a scalar field here. So in order to integrate this scalar, we need a volume form. So you see the G squared should be like a volume form. So G should be has dimension 1 over length. So there's a coupling, if you wish, there's a length scale in the theory, L Young-Mills. And there are several ways to think about it, that this is actually not a conformal field theory, so it depends very much, the theory depends on the volume of the world sheet on which you put it. And by picking a bigger volume, we basically tune the coupling constant to be bigger and smaller. So what we have is actually not one theory, but we have a family of theories. We have a one-parameter family of theories labeled by this Young-Mills coupling constant. And there are kind of two interesting limits. There's the limit where this coupling constant is zero, and there's the limit where this coupling constant is infinite. And this is clearly related to the scale on which we are looking at the theory. And so, if you wish, this is, in terms of the length scale on which you look, this is the infinite volume limit. So this is infinite volume, of what's also called the infrared limit. And this is very small volume, or the ultraviolet limit. And there's a naturally kind of ordering on this line that we typically have, the, say, the renormalization group, which bring you from small distances to long distances. But perhaps for the mathematician, it's important to see that just as one family of these quantum field theories. And we want to discuss the theory and also discuss, of course, these endpoints here and see how they behave. Now, so in general, the theory is not conformal invariant, so it depends on the volume. But of course, here, in the where we actually send the volume to infinity, now, now it doesn't depend on the volume anymore. So at this point here, you have a superconformal field theory. One way to think about this is to think about it, in, say, in terms of the cylinder. And you can think about kind of the radius of the space-like cylinder. So also in this limit here, where we take this ultraviolet limit, we somehow make the space-like cylinder very, very small. So effectively, we kind of, well, I will say this a bit more, but you expect perhaps here to be more like in a quantum mechanical regime. So this is the model. And it should, of course, also be provided with an interpretation, but I can actually be very brief about it. So the interpretation is the following. So this should be non-perturbative string theory, second quantized string theory, so of type 2a, in the limit where we sense, well, on what? On a space which is of the form R8 times S1 cross R11. So we in this discrete light cone quantization. And the P plus is given by N, where N is the rank of the gauge group. And P minus is given by the Hamiltonian of the super Young-Mills model divided by P plus. So this is the interpretation you want to give to this two-dimensional Young-Mills theory. And I will later discuss how it actually follows from an even more somehow fundamental proposal, which is the original matrix theory. But so this is often referred to as the matrix string. So what do I mean that it's non-perturbative theory? Well, we know that string theory is not just a free theory. It has interactions. So it has a non-trivial coupling constant. Actually, it has two things. It has a coupling constant and it has a natural length scale. So the final ingredient is to identify the coupling constant of string theory with the Young-Mills coupling constant. So in string theory, we have two things. We have little strings moving around, which have some typical length, which is the string length, and they can join and split. A thing I haven't been discussing yesterday, but you typically give a weight to such a fundamental process, a G-string. And so the last part in this identification is that the Young-Mills coupling constant should be given as 1 over, say, L-string, G-string. That is, in string units, that's another way to write it, is that the string coupling constant is the Young-Mills length divided by the string length. Let's see, am I writing this correct? Yes. So this is an important point because it shows that the limit where this, well, actually you can also look at this picture over here, that the limit where the string is not interacting is the regime where the Young-Mills coupling constant is infinitely big. So in terms of the picture over here, here would sit free string theory. And here, say, we would have interacting string theory. Now, it's quite surprising, I think, when first these matrix developments came about, that such a simple thing as two-dimensional Young-Mills could be a candidate for a theory of everything. Because actually, in mathematics, we already know that there was quite interesting developments about two-dimensional Young-Mills, but not really earth-shocking. And if you say, well, I solved Young-Mills theory, but now with extra supersymmetries, it looked like a very dumb exercise because, well, it's probably some small variation on the non-supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. But actually, this is completely the wrong intuition because actually doing these, actually there's very little difference between doing two-dimensional Young-Mills with these extra supersymmetries and actually doing 10-dimensional Young-Mills. Actually, the dynamics is almost as complicated. And it certainly won't be able to give an exact solution of this theory. So the one without the supersymmetry was exactly solved. Those were very nice papers of Witten a couple of years ago and various applications to mathematics. But somehow the intuition, if you were familiar with that work, is completely the wrong intuition to think about this theory here. Actually, that part of mathematics is not playing a role at all. All the meat is, say, in this field X, which are absent in the usual Young-Mills system. So it's a very, very different game. And I guess I kind of explained the claims. And I now want to make a start of kind of presenting evidence that this actually might be the right way to think about it. And as I said, it's very difficult to solve this theory. Although somehow it's a very simple Lagrangian, it's two-dimensional, you might think, well, that's easy. Yes. Right.
And
oh, certainly. In a special limit.
And then this formula is, so, I mean, that in that way, this
Yes.
Formula.
It looks very different.
Exactly. No. It's exactly the same as potential formula as t goes to 100 j. And
right.
You could reinterpret what you're saying when you become the string theory and prove the best duality is going to be.
Well, of course. I mean, one way to motivate is that these strings, type 2b, these strings, interact in a very different way than fundamental strings, because they interact in this kind of using this non-abelian language. And you're quite right. So
but when you're going to recover, as you're going to do,
yes,
to
sure,
strings,
sure. So no, I completely agree.
I just want to say that one way
yes,
of what you're doing
yes,
is
right,
to
sure, yes. In a certain regime, I think,
well,
because we're not using the Born-Imfeld Lagrangian here and things like that. But it's definitely part of the intuition. Like, that's certainly at least how we thought. But
I suppose to think of this as a sort of duality between free string theory and this two-dimensional game.
Yeah, so you should think about it in the way I started, that somehow we're doing two things at the same time. We were going to second quantize the theory, and we're going to introduce the interactions at one stroke by promoting all the coordinates into matrices.
But we're coupling in the
yes. Yeah, right. Yes. So perturbative, the question is whether, for instance, perturbation theory in two-dimensional Young nulls will teach you anything.
Right.
But certainly will teach you something about a regime that you can't approach using, say, old-fashioned conformal field theory. You can't draw Riemann surfaces. So the Riemann surfaces, I claim, are only drawn in this place where we have the superconformal field theory. So let me just make a claim and then try to prove it, or at least give evidence for it. So I said that we have this general quantum field theory which depends on one parameter, and we know that if we scale the parameter to infinity, we go to this one point, that we get a conformal field theory. So the question is, what is the conformal field theory we're getting? So we start with Young-Mills, we get a conformal field theory out. So what is the candidate for this superconformal field theory? And the claim is that this is a sigma model on a familiar space by now, namely the space is a symmetric product of R8. So once I've shown that, you would say, oh, I can this also interpret it as second quantized strings, say free second quantized strings. That's actually the thing I now want to do. So I won't say anything about interactions today, but I just want to see how this particular point in the moduli space of this one parameter moduli space of Young-Mills theories, that particular point is a sigma model. Now, one way to see this, at least, is to look again at this Lagrangian and see what the properties of the Lagrangian are in the case that the coupling constant, G Young-Mills, goes to infinity. So let's just see what happens to the terms. So we see that the terms which are underlined, which are like the sigma model terms, nothing happens to it. The coupling constant of Young-Mills goes to infinity, so somehow that whole term disappears. There's no kinetic term anymore for F. But then these two terms here, well, they typically, the coefficient will blow up. So the only way that the path integral will receive contributions if these terms here actually vanish. So let's concentrate on the bosonic term. So we see immediately that we, in this limit, we have to demand that these matrices start to commute. So that's the important step. Now, what does this mean? That means that they can simultaneously diagonalize. So it's important to realize, just to make it precise, that all my fields here are single-valued. But I know somehow there's not really topological sectors, because there are no non-trivial UN bundles on the circle. So the xi's can now be simultaneously diagonalized. So I write them in terms of U, where U is a unitary matrix. Of course, they can all, and they all depend on sigma. And then I have J1. Here I have the eigenvalues. And here I have U inverse. So it looks like this is very straightforward, but now there's one important point. Of course, there's still a gauge symmetry here. And if you have 8 matrices which are simultaneously commuting, their eigenvalues, the spectrum of the operators is the gauge invariant quantity, but not the individual eigenvalues. Of course, the ordering of the eigenvalues doesn't mean anything. So that's actually, you can say quite straightforward now, that these x's, or these eigenvalues, if you wish, they lie in this symmetric product. Because what would we have? We have 8 times n. Every matrix has n eigenvalues. We have 8 of these matrices, but there's still the symmetric group acting, which might permute these eigenvalues. So another way to say this is, even though the matrix is single-valued, this diagonal matrix and this matrix U need not be single-valued. Only the total combination has to be single-valued. So there is the possibility of spectral flow, which means the following. So here we have the eigenvalues of the matrix. Here we have the coordinate sigma, which runs from 0 to 2 pi. But if you see what happens to the individual eigenvalues, we know that as a set, the set is periodic, but of course you could have the phenomena that the eigenvalues themselves, the individual eigenvalues, have some twist. So these diagonal matrices, let's call them small xj, they can have the property that if I go around, that there is a group element acting on them. And this group element, of course, is an element of the symmetric group, which is the might permute the individual eigenvalues. So we see there is, just as an orbifold, so this is, again, this is the orbifold R A times N over Sn, there is the possibility of twisted sectors. Now, this is one step, so we see indeed that somehow the bosonic scalar fields will now be coordinates on this orbifold, the symmetric space. Of course, we also have to discuss what happens to the gauge field, because that's certainly part of it, and of course the fermions, but the fermions are not that interesting. So let me comment briefly on the gauge field. Well, perhaps before I actually do it, it's good to review what happens in the case of bosonic Yang-Mills theory, because that's something we... So just do Maxwell theory. Yes? Why you can't have individual... Yes. Right. So at every point you can simultaneously diagonalize. And you know which eigenvalues belong to which matrix. Yes. Right. Yes. 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 Okay. Of course, if the matrices don't commute, we still have the eigenvalues of them. And then, of course, there's the situation where you are thinking about them. Then they have this, each has its own spectrum. But since they are simultaneously, can be simultaneously diagonalized, we know how to... Right, it's the Weyl group which acts on the Cartan-Lie algebra. That's another way to think about it, of course. Yes. So just to kind of get some intuition of what... that this limit, actually, is a limit which, in the case of the bosonic Yang-Mills theory, basically throws away everything. I would just want to make that point. If you have, say, two-dimensional Maxwell theory... So that's the thing we basically all know. So we have just a Lagrangian G Yang-Mills squared... F squared. Well, there are various ways. This model is very easy to exactly solve. For instance, one way is to go to this first order formalism and to write it as phi times F plus G squared Yang-Mills phi squared. Then you realize if you have a connection in two dimensions, there are not that many physical degrees of freedom. But first, you can use gauge transformation to put A naught to zero. And then are the spatial gauge transformations, which leaves you as the only kind of interesting observable, the total holonomy around the circle, so the exponent of the spatial component d sigma. And this is, of course, a phase factor, e to the 2 pi I theta. And then you can think of this field phi as just being the canonical conjugate to theta, just the momentum of this theta variable. So if you're very two-dimensional Young-Mills, it's just a quantum mechanical system. In general, it's quantum mechanics on the group, the G-invariant quantum mechanics on G. So the Hamiltonian in this case, if you wish to just integral this, the sigma of G Young-Mills squared phi squared, and that means that if you now take wave functions, so the wave functions of the theory, you have wave functions labeled by an integer n, and they just go like e n theta, just the representations of un, of a u1, and this thing then just becomes, of course, and so if you evaluate h on such a wave function, the eigenvalue is just g Young-Mills squared n squared. So you see the energies go proportional with g squared Young-Mills. So for instance, if you compute the partition function, say on the cylinder, so you take the trace of the evolution operator, you get this famous theta functions, g Young-Mills squared n squared. So a very simple spectrum of the theory. But now you see if you sense Young-Mills coupling constant to infinity, that basically all the states have infinite energy. So this just goes to 1 in this, say, superconformal field theory limit. And the only state that remains is the state psi naught, which is the vacuum. So this infinite coupling limit throws away most of the Young-Mills theory. Only the vacuum, in the usual, if you have an abelian theory, only the vacuum survives. So it's an important piece of intuition, because most of the applications of two-dimensional Young-Mills were, we will see these states coming back later. They will play an important role when we discuss the theory at the when the coupling constant is not infinite. But right now, in this particular limit, we see that we're throwing away all the modes of the gauge field. So first of all, two-dimensional gauge field doesn't have too many modes. Whatever there is will be thrown away. And to make it a little bit more precise, so this is, of course, for the abelian case. So what about the non-abelian case? Well, we have to realize one thing, of course. Say we have symmetry breaking. So let's take the simplest case where this group element in Sn is just the identity. And let's just take constants, so we expand these X matrices around some constant value. So we pick some point in this space SNR, and we do, say, a perturbative expansion around that point. And then we know if we rescale, that's the usual thing of symmetry breaking, if we rescale also the gauge field in such a way that the Young-Mills coupling constant disappears from the kinetic term, and we just expand the covariant derivative in the kinetic term for the X fields, that out of this will be a term which I think Greg also wrote down several times, which looks like this, xi minus xj squared. But these are the off-diagonal components of the matrix, the connection. So we see that this is, of course, the usual Higgs phenomena. The off-diagonal components of the matrix, the connection matrix, acquire a mass, and the mass is proportional to the difference of these eigenvalues. So if these eigenvalues are not coinciding, so we are not on the diagonals of this symmetric space, and that will actually play an important role when we discuss the theory with interactions. And we send this Young-Mills coupling constant to infinity, it will actually, these modes will have infinite mass, and they will decouple for that reason. So the argument is that you have a UN gauge field. By this mechanism, you break the gauge group from UN to the diagonal one, to the Cartan, U1 to the N. The off-diagonal components become infinitely massive. They will not contribute to the partition function. And the abelian ones basically reproduce the Maxwell theory. And we see also that in this Maxwell theory, it's only the vacuum which survives. So all in all, the only contribution of interesting state that will contribute in the particular limit is the vacuum state of the Young-Mills theory. So there's no interesting information in the Young-Mills part. The only thing that the Young-Mills theory does for us is that it allows, if you wish, these monodromies of these eigenvalues. Yes. Right. No, but you're quite right. I mean, it's. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. But here, I'm using this some adiabatic limit somehow. Right. Yes. Yes. Decouple. But that's, I think, where the non-trivial parts reside. And in that sense, there's no kind of proof. Although, actually, it might be something that you might try to prove mathematically, that this sigma model is, because both the Young-Mills theory and the sigma model is perfectly well-defined as a two-dimensional quantum field theory. I mean, there are various ways in which you can, I think, rigorously define it. So it's, I think, a very well-defined question whether this limit for G to infinity is indeed the superconformal field theory. With so much supersymmetry, you mean?
Yeah.
I think actually, I wouldn't know. Well, it's actually even more because there's even this kind of super Galilean symmetry.
Well,
at least there are no moduli. Right. Yes. It's a very strong candidate, I think. Yes. It's about classifying superconformal field theories with these 16 supercharges and having this kind of eight-dimensional Galilean symmetry. But certainly, it's an isolated point, so there are no moduli. That's also important. So it's not that you can slightly deform the model. But well, yeah, but the thing is whether you can somehow, by abstract arguments, reconstruct the X fields and. Well, perhaps making this argument more precise, but I myself have no immediate ideas how to approach it. So the upshot is here that, let me just continue for a few moments. So let's assume that, well, at least this is about the evidence we can give, so it's a little bit of physicist proof, that at least this super Young-Mills theory in this one particular point is the sigma model on the symmetric product. And now we can actually kind of borrow the things I've said yesterday, where I basically draw the conclusion that the sigma model on a string moving on the symmetric product is the same as n symmetric product. It's the same thing as n strings. And so in that sense, we see that this sigma model on the symmetric product describes for us a guess of strings. But the strings are not interacting. We have the Hilbert space. Their Hilbert space is a Fock space. And the Hamiltonian is just the sum of the Hamiltonians of the individual strings. So it's a free theory. So we see, and that's not, in that sense, not very deep, that this theory that sits over here describes for us a gas of free strings. Now, the non-trivial ingredient will be that the theory outside this fixed point will be, again, a theory, but now a theory of interacting strings. So what I want to show tomorrow is how we can see from the Young-Mills the joining and splitting of strings. So I will claim, then, that if we go beyond this point, that these strings that I've reproduced over here, these eigenvalues, here, these long strings, will actually start to connect and disconnect and will form Riemann surfaces. From the superconformal point of view, but I'll... Sorry? Yes, that's true. Based on this presumption. Yes. I agree. Yes, I will make very... I mean, it's certainly... still kind of wonderful open problem to say anything sensible of the Young-Mills theory itself. So I will have to go around the corner somehow. It's a kind of not a straightforward attack of this Young-Mills theory. You can try to do this, but it's right now nobody really did it. But at least I will show in some way how the interactions of the strings can appear from this picture we have over here. And roughly what it will correspond to is that we... Well, no, I won't say anything more. So I think this is a good point to stop today.